In the new book, The Sex Obsession, Perversity and Possibility in American Politics, Janet Jacobson, professor of women's gender and sexuality studies at Columbia's Barnard College, takes up the issue of sexual politics with the intention of illuminating not only why sex and our politics have become so enmeshed, but if their relationship might be anything other than divisive, if and how even an expanded perspective on the subject might recast it as a means of cultivating social justice. Again, the name of the book is The Sex Obsession, and it's a pleasure to welcome Janet Jacobson to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe, for having me on.
It's a great pleasure to have you on the program. So what brought you to this subject?
My PhD is in religious ethics, so I've studied religious efforts in politics, particularly through social movements. As you probably know, in U.S. politics on both the left and the right, many movements have been propelled by religious commitments, and so I've long studied those movements. And I had been an administrator at my college, both serving as the director of the Center for Research on Women and as a dean, and I stepped down from those responsibilities in 2015. And as I looked around me, I saw that we were in the midst of a new set of political configurations. You'll remember the 2016 election started in 2015. And so I thought that it would be helpful to see if I could figure out what was happening around me using my long training. And this is the book that resulted.
So when it comes to sex and social justice, how do they connect?
For one thing, one of the central arguments of the book is that sexual politics is central to all different kinds of issues in the United States. So we tend to look at sexual politics as about a set of issues narrowly focused on gender and sexuality, and that's obviously true. Same-sex marriage, equal pay, these are all concerns about sexual politics. But sexual politics also plays into a number of other issues. In the book, I look at the structure of the welfare state and how we understood welfare reform, as it was called, in the 1990s. I look at immigration. I look at economic policy more widely and war and peace, and think about the ways in which gender and sexuality play into those issues. And in fact, they are often central to what politicians in the U.S. Have to say about these issues. And if that's true, that means that thinking differently about sexual politics could also help us to think differently about that full range of issues and about how best to bring about social justice in the United States and more broadly.
And you make the point that many of us may think that it is religion that is solely driving that, but you say there are many other factors as well.
Yes, one of the main arguments of the book is that we pull gender and sexuality out of this wide range of issues, and then we oppose it to a certain set of religious commitments, which are not held by all religious people. In fact, what happens is we narrow gender and sexuality to a small set of issues. We then narrow it to how religion thinks about those. We then narrow religion to a small set of Christian perspectives, and that sets up this binary opposition that seems so hard to get out of. And so one of the things that the book is about is trying to put gender and sexuality back in its context in relation to the full range of issues, in relation to race, racism, and racial justice in the United States, in relation to a set of class and economic issues, et cetera. So that's one of the ways in which the book tries to break out of the narrow, binary, and divisive opposition we find ourselves in.
So you look, and speaking on that, when you look at the 2016 election and the fact that President Trump was elected with very strong support from white evangelical Christians, A, how does that make sense? And B, how has it continued to make sense?
Yes. So a couple things on that. First of all, we have to be very clear that this is even a subset of white evangelical Christians. So conservative white evangelical Christians who support President Trump do not represent all evangelical Christians, and they don't represent all Christians, and they certainly don't represent all religions. But they do represent those for whom sexual politics is a central issue on the conservative side. And what they are interested in, and we saw this again in the past week with Jerry Falwell Jr., is not necessarily the sexual practices of individuals, but rather a sexual politics around the nation. And there was a new book out in march on specifically Christian nationalism that argues that that's the most important key to support for Trump, not Christian commitment, not Christian belief, but a commitment to nationalism. And sexual politics plays into that nationalism in a way that allows people, and has for decades allowed people who are committed to Christian nationalism, to overlook the sexual practices, including serious charges like those that have been made against President Trump of sexual coercion, to overlook those for the sake of this sexual politics in favor of nationalism.
You say overlook, but it is a, it's also a hypocrisy, isn't it?
Yes, I just think that when we focus on hypocrisy, it's obviously a hypocrisy. And again, I want to emphasize that this has gone on for decades. The leader of the family values movement in the 1990s with Newt Gingrich, who had a record of adultery and divorce and remarriage. So it is not as though commitment to personal sexual ethics has ever been required of the leaders of those who would promote conservative sexual politics. And my concern about hypocrisy, when we talk about it in those terms, is we tend to focus on the individuals and whether they're hypocrites or not, instead of focusing on the politics and what it means for us to try to say that there should be sexual politics, a conservative version of sexuality that is in some way enforced by or supported by law. And that's just very different than individual hypocrisy, although that's obviously involved as well.
You make a point that I found fascinating in the book. It seems very important to me, which is that we so often look through what we refer to as lenses. And if you look at an issue through this lens, if you look at an issue through that lens, you suggest the metaphor of a kaleidoscope, which does seem to make a lot more sense.
Yeah, I mean, and one of the things that we find, that I found in looking back over U.S. politics since the 1970s, is that kaleidoscope turns often. Sometimes we are primarily focused on questions of economics. You know, Clinton famously ran on the "it's the economy, stupid" slogan, even though I show that his vision of the economy was deeply entwined with a certain vision of sexual politics. He talked a lot about, you know, teenage motherhood, and played into a whole round of what we now understand to be very racist ideas about sexual promiscuity. And so, you know, that sense that we turn and we focus on the economy and race and gender and sexuality fade into the background, and then we turn and we focus on race and then gender and sexuality and the economy fade into the background, and we're constantly being asked to pick which one is the most important one. And what I found was that it's actually the dynamic relations among all of these, and this is something we have heard from black feminists as well, with Kimberly Crenshaw's idea of intersectionality and the like, that it's really important to look at issues in relation to each other.
When it comes to talking about sex in this country, whether it be about sexual politics or sex itself, identity, anything really, it seems that compared to other cultures around the world that are more evolved, we're not very good at it.
Well, yeah. I mean, one can always get into trouble with cultural comparisons if one isn't very careful. But it is the case that there are many other countries in the world where, for example, ready availability of sex education for young people and adolescents, ready availability and openness in talking about contraception, you know, that there are a series of issues that we have a very hard time talking about in the United States that other countries don't seem to have a similar problem with and similar debates about. And at the same time, we have a culture that is suffused with gender and sexuality, both politically and in terms of popular culture and the like. And so one of the arguments of the book is precisely this: let's be able to talk more directly about gender and sexuality and about sexual politics as a way to try to open up a range of possibilities for how we might understand our political life and our sexual lives.
What's a good starting place for that conversation?
Well, I think a good starting place, and this is one of the sort of counterintuitive ideas of the book, would be to look at a broader range of religious ideas about gender and sexuality that, you know, usually you would not say, oh, a good starting place is to think about religion. But When you think about religious commitments to social justice in a number of movements, including feminist movements and anti-racist movements and the like, what you see is a willingness of many religious people to talk very openly about the ways in which, for example, being open to gender and sexual lives that provide community or collective support beyond the bounds of simply the nuclear family. You know, that's a conversation that's being had actually in religious circles in relation to social justice, and that's not usually where we would look. So in that sense, I think that opening up to ideas, broader ideas about religion could actually be helpful, which is the counterintuitive claim of the book. And then there's all kinds of social movement places where people have thought through a range of ideas about feminism, about reproductive justice, for example, as opposed to just reproductive rights, which is a broadening of that particular lens on how we think about reproductivity and the need to support people in their reproductive lives when they want to have children and when they don't want to have children. That's a different approach than the ways that we usually talk about those issues in the mainstream public that has been driven by black feminists. So there are a lot of different places to look, and some of them are unusual. And I would include in that certain religious circles dedicated to social justice.
Within even those circles, there are many lessons to be learned. And as we have these conversations, how do you see change? How do you see the building of justice from the ground up?
Well, yes. I mean, I come from a long tradition of, I was in between college and when I went to graduate school, I worked in community organizing to some extent on homelessness. I worked for a church and trade union sponsored organization called the Washington Office on Africa in the 1980s, which did anti-apartheid work. And I do think that people talking to each other and learning to care for each other at local levels is very, very important. I think that efforts, for example, at mutual aid during the pandemic, when people have had all different kinds of needs that would be variously met, whether it's trying to figure out how to care for your children or trying to figure out how to get food into the house, that neighbors have tried to help each other, or pods of people have come together beyond just their own families to try to help each other, or some people have been talking about the importance of something like co-housing, where people live in closer community with more shared public space, even as they have private space. So thinking about just these different ways about how we are trying to make it through this pandemic and attending to those as having the seeds of solutions for broader problems as well could be very helpful.
You write a lot about the Supreme Court in the book, and it seems to me that that makes the argument of this election being so important even more so because of the balance of the court.
Yes, no, I think the balance of the court is crucially important. I also think that thinking about how we understand the Supreme Court is important for our broader political discourse, because we've seen that there were times when the court understood its position within the broader democracy of the United States as protecting those whose rights were under attack by majority rules, so that part of the reason to have courts and have the protection of rights is not because of the way rights inhere in people or something, but because in a democracy that focuses on the majority, minorities also need to have institutional sites of protection. And we now see a switch in the full understanding of the court, so that sense of what the court might be about in checks and balances is being lost, so that it's not just on a particular set of issues, is it conservative, is it liberal, but how do we understand the institution itself? And how do we understand it in relation to this whole complex of issues that I talk about in the book? And shifting that understanding, it seems to me, having more discussion of it is very important. But there's been all kinds of discussion on the right about what the view of what the court should be doing is. There's been much less articulation from progressives about what the court should be doing as an institution as opposed to on specific issues.
Is now the time for progressives and those on the left to have those discussions, meaning over the next 60 days, or let's worry about the election first?
Well, that's a great question, and it's very hard also not to worry about the election first. But I do think that some sense about the court's contributions to democracy, one of the questions that the book asks is this, that you're always asked, you know, to present your position in a left-right, you know, binary. And one of the things that gets lost in that is that the ability to talk about a broader set of commitments can often be lost. And so re-articulating, you know, what religious freedom can mean, for example, beyond what it has come to mean, especially in the last 4 years, there's been a really strong push for it to mean only an application to a certain kind of Christianity. You know, we saw that in the distinction under Jeff Sessions between his support for the early ban on travel from majority Muslim countries and his claims on behalf of being a new defender of religious freedom. And it's like, well, what about the freedom of those people who you just banned from entering the country? You know, being able to articulate the court as a site of a democratic institution, being able to articulate religious freedom as a broader value, I think could actually help in the election, in thinking that we don't have to come out of this election with just the progressive side now defeating a conservative side. We could come out of this election with new commitments to democratic engagement with each other and with a broader sense of who belongs to the public.
The name of the new book is The Sex Obsession, Perversity, and Possibility in American Politics. The book is published by New York University Press. Janet Jacobson, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, The Sex Obsession. It's published by NYU Press. Janet Jacobson is the author. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.